Hello, and welcome to Science World. Reporting from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, Elizabeth Lee will update us on NASA's Dawn mission to the dwarf planet Ceres. Doug Bernard tells us about a new program that will offer inexpensive adjustable eyeglasses to people in Rwanda. And we'll learn how our ancient ancestors boosted human evolution by creating the world's first tools several million years ago. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA Science, Health, and Technology Magazine, Science World. NASA's Dawn spacecraft will soon reach the dwarf planet Ceres. Once it starts orbiting Ceres, Dawn will gather clues about how it evolved and whether this icy body may have once had conditions conducive to supporting life. Elizabeth Lee reports from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Los Angeles.
Two, main engine start. One, zero, and liftoff of the Delta II rocket with Dawn.
Dawn left Earth more than 7 years ago on a course to explore two alien worlds in the solar system.
This is the first time in more than 57 years of space exploration that we've had a spacecraft targeted to orbit any two extraterrestrial destinations.
Dawn Chief Engineer and Mission Director Mark Raymond says the two destinations are Vesta and Ceres, in the main asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. They are considered protoplanets.
It and Ceres were in the process of growing to become full-sized planets when their growth was terminated.
At the Dawn Mission Control Center in Los Angeles, the flight team sends second-by-second instructions to the spacecraft, directing its every move, including the images it takes of what it sees. Dawn is now approaching Ceres and is expected to enter its orbit in March. Scientists believe Ceres is made of rock covered with a mantle of ice. Dawn will take images and make a comprehensive map of this alien world. It will also examine Ceres' composition to provide data on how its surface has evolved and whether it could have been conducive to life, says Carol Raymond, the mission's deputy principal investigator.
One of the interests in bodies like Ceres and other icy bodies in the outer solar system is that when objects like that impacted the terrestrial planets, they brought a lot of water with them. And so there's a very vigorous debate at the current time as to whether wet asteroids like Ceres, and we know there are other wet asteroids in the outer edge of the main belt, whether they were the dominant source of water in the Earth's ocean.
Earlier in its mission, Dawn made an unexpected discovery while orbiting the protoplanet Vesta.
Quite to the surprise of the team, that instead of being bone dry, which we expected, there were patches of the surface of Vesta that showed significant amounts of water bound in the rocks and possibly even free water that could have flowed on the surface in the past.
Raymond says if Earth's water came from wet worlds like these, then life could have come with them as well. If Dawn reveals that the environment on Ceres could be conducive to life, the finding may spur further explorations with other types of instruments to test that hypothesis. As for Dawn, it will gather information on Ceres until the summer of 2016. Then it will continue to orbit the dwarf planet indefinitely. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
In poor countries such as Rwanda, it may take a lot more time, effort, and money to get a pair of prescription glasses than in more developed nations. But soon, up to 1 million Rwandans with poor vision will soon start testing new affordable glasses that they can adjust to sharpen their sight. Science World's Doug Bernard tells us more.
95% of people in sub-Saharan Africa who need glasses don't own a pair. That's according to the Britain-based charity foundation Vision for a Nation. Its founder, philanthropist James Chen, says Rwanda is one of those nations where the need for glasses is great, especially among school children.
We expect that perhaps a million people in Rwanda will need some form of vision correction. And out of that, probably 900,000 people will just need a simple reading glass, and we will be able to supply that. Or it would be our adjustable glasses.
Using technology developed at Oxford University, Ched's company AdLens manufactures two types of adjustable glasses. He says they're very easy to use and have a wide range of magnification.
You have two lenses as they move against each other. In the part of the eye that you can see out, you know, the power changes with the two lenses moving against each other. The other technology we have is the fluid-filled, which is a chamber. On one side you have a plastic sheet, and as you put in the fluid, which is a silicone oil, it changes the curvature of that. And so that's what's changing the power.
AdLens ophthalmologist Graham McKenzie says the glasses are especially suitable for people with variable eyesight.
If your eyesight does fluctuate from day to day or even minute to minute, you can just readjust the lens power to meet your needs. The technology as it currently stands has a very high power range. So high, in fact, that we can capture 90% of all the sorts of refractive errors that are out in the world.
With a subsidy from the World Bank, Rwandans will pay only about $1.50 for the adjustable glasses. That, however, is still about 3 days' wages in that country. Vision for a Nation Foundation has trained some 1,200 nurses to help the vision impaired learn how to use them. If everything goes well with the distribution and adoption of adjustable lenses in Rwanda, Vision for a Nation plans to distribute them in other countries as well. For Science World, I'm Doug Bernard.
Pilots of the solar plane that already set records flying without a drop of fuel are close to making their first attempt to fly the aircraft around the globe. George Putich reports.
Solar Impulse 2, or SI-2 for short, arrived in Abu Dhabi in pieces. Built mainly of lightweight glass-reinforced plastic, it is now being reassembled and prepared for its journey around the globe. The concept was previously tested by its predecessor, Solar Impulse 1, in 2012 during a long flight from Europe to North Africa, and in 2013 flying across the United States. SI-2's 72-meter-long wings are covered with more than 17,000 solar cells that can generate up to 52 kilowatts of power. The cells also charge batteries, which run the plane's four electric motors at night. The single-seat plane, which will take off from Abu Dhabi, will follow a course roughly along the equator, where the sun is strongest, touching down only every few days. Two pilots will take turns in the cockpit during those stops. Project co-founder Bertrand Piccard, who is one of the pilots, says the flight will require a lot of endurance.
It's very exciting for everybody, and we are also in the psychological preparation of the pilot and the team, because technology is okay. But you need to cope now with very long duration flights, single pilot on board for 5 days and five nights. A lot of stress for everybody.
Co-founder and alternate pilot Andre Borsberg says although SI-2 can fly on autopilot, they plan to rest or sleep only 20 minutes at a time.
How many of these breaks we will be able to take per night is hard to say. We've trained in a simulator to have 6 to 8 of them every 24 hours, which means about 2 hours of sleep every 24 hours, which is not a lot.
Bertrand Piccard says the project's goal is to demonstrate the advantages of renewable energy sources and clean technologies.
If an airplane can fly with no fuel around the world, can you imagine how these technologies could be used everywhere?
SI-2 is scheduled to take off in March and return to Abu Dhabi sometime in July. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Speaking of airplanes, for this week's Science World Quick Quiz, which of the following people is credited with making the first solo airplane trip around the world? Is it A, Charles Lindbergh, B, Richard Byrd, or C, Wiley Post? Think about it, and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer a few minutes from now.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
you'll find coastal towns throughout the world where tsunamis could and have caused devastation. One low-lying coastal town in Washington State is copying a strategy used in Japan to survive tsunamis. Tom Bonsi reports from Westport, Washington.
Around this time next year, Okasta Elementary School will have a new gym with a reinforced roof that can double as a tsunami refuge. This will be the first structure in North America purposely designed for tsunami vertical evacuation. Students say the rare catastrophe weighs on their minds, living as they do at the edge of the ocean. Their hometown of Westport, Washington is basically one long sandspit. The elementary and high schools were built on one of the highest dune ridges around, but that's only about 8 meters above sea level, and that may not be high enough in the worst-case scenario, a magnitude 9.0 full rip of the offshore Cascadia fault line. Models predict the subsequent tsunami will wash over pretty much everything for miles around. Structural engineer Cale Ash took that as a design challenge.
The extra features would include the pile foundations, which were made a little bit larger in diameter and also deeper to make sure they could resist any scour, any washing away of the site that would happen from the tsunami flow. The building's also designed to resist impact. As the water comes in, it can bring debris like logs and vehicles and other stuff.
Four outside stairways lead to a flat, concrete and steel reinforced roof capable of holding more than 1,000 people. Ash says the rooftop refuge is about 4 meters above the maximum estimated tsunami height.
Vertical evacuation, to me, it is never the preferable option.
Geologist Lori Dengler is an earthquake and tsunami expert at Humboldt State University in California.
And if you talk to any emergency manager, they are not going to want to have people isolated in the top of a building, possibly for days or maybe even a week or longer.
That said, Dengler understands sometimes the last choice is the only choice. In places like Westport and Ocean Shores, Washington, and Seaside, Oregon, she says vertical evacuation could offer the only chance of survival and should be looked at. But she stresses a key issue whenever such an evacuation structure is built is it tall enough? After the devastating 2011 tsunami in Japan, the geology professor participated in a survey of the disaster zone that examined the performance of vertical evacuation. The Japanese coast is the only place in the world where designated vertical evacuation structures are common. Dengler points out that if a tsunami turns out to be a little bigger than expected, people who evacuate inland to high ground can continue to go up or further inland.
But once you're on the third or the fourth floor of a four-story building, you can't go any higher.
Elsewhere, a handful of low-lying communities are planning another kind of tsunami safe haven. In Long Beach, Washington, Humboldt County, California, and Padang, Indonesia, residents have proposed building tall earthen mounds. The prototype proposed on the southwestern coast of Sumatra is designed with a park on top that could hold many hundreds of people. Like Westport, many residents in the crowded city of Padang would not be able to evacuate to high ground in the limited time they'll have after a big quake. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Westport, Washington.
While scientists are hesitant to call it a cure, they have succeeded in significantly reducing and, in some cases, reversing disability caused by the crippling disorder multiple sclerosis by using the patient's own stem cells in a single treatment. Jessica Berman reports.
The stem cells are collected from the patient's blood, and they're used to reset the immune system. So the body's fighter cells no longer mistake the patient's own nervous system tissue for an invader. Those attacks cause disability and autoimmune diseases like multiple sclerosis. MS is a degenerative disease. 10 years after being diagnosed, half of all MS patients are unable to work, and after 25 years with the disease, half lose the ability to walk. Richard Burt is chief of the Division of Immunotherapy at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. He led a study of 150 MS patients, most with the mildest form of the disease called relapsing remitting MS, in which they received the stem cell therapy. He says their disability seemed to reverse itself or disappear.
This is a one-time treatment, and then you're done. And so, we hope patients never need to be treated again.
About half of the patients tested 2 years after the study showed significant improvement in their movement and cognitive function. Of the 36 participants tested after 4 years, 23 had continued improvement of their symptoms, and 80% were free of relapses or flare-ups. 10% of patients required another treatment after 5 years. Some of the participants who had a more serious form of MS did not improve. MS disease progression and severity are measured by the number of lesions in the brain seen by high-tech imaging. Most of the patients who received the stem cells had fewer brain lesions. Treatment for multiple sclerosis is expensive, typically close to $50,000 or more per year. While stem cell therapy would also cost a lot of money, most likely a lot more than current treatments, Burt says it could be more cost efficient.
One-time treatment like this could be cost-effective. It may actually be a cost saver for society, a win-win where the patient gets better, quality of life improves, they're free of medications, the majority for a long period of time, and may end up, if you look at it over at least 18 months, start saving money for society.
Burt says the results for the long term are promising, but he remains cautious about the lasting effects of the treatment. Studies of the stem cell therapy for multiple sclerosis continue at Northwestern University and in Brazil, Sweden, and the United Kingdom. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. Today, we wanted to know which of the following people is credited with making the first solo airplane trip around the world. Is it A, Charles Lindbergh, B, Richard Byrd, or C, Wiley Post? Although he was the first to make a solo and nonstop transatlantic flight, it's not A, Charles Lindbergh, and it wasn't B, Richard Byrd either. So that means the answer is C. Aviator Wiley Post began the first solo flight around the world on July 15, 1933, in New York, and he completed his 25,000-kilometer global journey a week later on July 22, 1933, when he returned to a starting point in New York. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
A couple of million years ago, our ancient human ancestors created the world's first tools when they broke some rocks into sharp shards so that they could slice apart and butcher game such as gazelles or zebras. A new study by an international group of researchers suggests that evolution not only gave our ancient ancestors the ability to create and use these tools, but the tools themselves became a force that further drove evolution. Since everyone wanted these tools, an effective way to communicate with and teach others how to make and use the tools was needed. This meant that our ancient ancestors had to develop advanced verbal skills, including language. Dr. Thomas Morgan, from the University of California, Berkeley, is the lead author of this study, and he joins us today to tell us what he and his colleagues learned from their research. Can you give us a little bit of a background on the development of these butchering tools and how they were developed and why they were developed?
The earliest known tools are from about 2.5 million years ago, and they're the sorts of tools we were looking at in our study. And they're the simplest ones are just called flakes. So they were made by striking a larger piece of certain types of rocks with a small hard hammer stone, and that would shatter off small pieces of rock called flakes that had very sharp edges. And these were just used to butcher the carcasses of dead animals quickly and effectively. So these tools are the dominant tool making for about 700,000 years, until around 1.8 million years ago, when the much more complicated Acheulean tools appear, and they're much more elaborate, much larger, and much more durable.
The basis for your research and your findings are the ability to create tools can probably be linked to evolution, but the research conducted by you and your UK colleagues indicates that the creation of the tools also led to evolutionary changes. Could you tell us about this?
The traditional view was that human evolution would have led to us having enhanced cognitive abilities, and with those abilities we could have worked out how to make these tools. But actually, a more popular view today, and this is what we provide evidence for, is that actually it was the making of the tools themselves that generated the conditions that favored the evolution of complex forms of cognition. So in particular, we were looking at teaching and language. And we found that even these very early tools, the people learn them much more effectively if they have a teacher, particularly a teacher who can use language. And so what we're suggesting is that even 2.5 million years ago, reliance on these tools would have meant that there was an evolutionary advantage that would have started on the path towards the evolution of teaching and language. So these early tools, the fact that they are the only tools available for around 700,000 years, suggests to us that during this period, the communication that our ancestors could engage in was sufficiently limited that they couldn't share any new ideas they had. So it might have been that our ancestors during this time were coming up with more elaborate ideas for tool making, but they weren't able to share them effectively with their group members, and so it never really took off. However, when we get to about 1.8 million years ago, when the new types of tools do take off, to us, that suggests that there must have been some development in communication that allowed this to happen. And we suggest that this minimally involves some form of teaching. It's also plausible that it could be some very simple type of proto-language involving very basic concepts, so not a lot like a modern language that is very elaborate, but still, a very early precursor to modern language.
What kind of experiments were conducted?
So we conducted a study where we taught, it was just over 180 students from the University of St Andrews in Scotland. We taught them to make the older one flaked tools, so the oldest type of tools known. And what we did was we split the participants into five different groups, and we taught them in different ways. So in the simplest group, they received no teaching whatsoever. They just got to look at some tools that someone else had made and had to try and work it out for themselves. Another group was allowed to watch someone else making the tools, but they couldn't interact with them. And then in the more complex groups, they were being taught by someone, either through gestures in one case or through verbal language in another case. And what we did is, after the teaching, we then tested the participants to see how much the skill they had acquired. And what we saw was that actually, with just the reverse engineering from someone else's tools but without interaction, and just watching someone else make tools, was not a very effective way to share the knowledge of how to make these tools. But teaching, and in particular teaching with language, was incredibly effective.
So what do you hope people will be able to take away from your research and findings?
The big finding that I'm particularly excited about is the idea that human evolution, it's not just a story of our ancestors evolving in response to environmental conditions, but it's actually the case that we made those conditions ourselves. So this process is sometimes called gene culture coevolution, where our genes and our culture are evolving in response to each other in one single process. And to me, this idea that human culture was shaping human evolution across huge expanses of time, I find very exciting. Carrying out the experiment was obviously a really interesting experience, just watching all these students try their hand at making these tools, which is obviously something that most people never really get a chance to do. One thing that surprised me is that actually, when people were taught with language, although they did much better, to me at least, watching them, they seemed to be less exploratory. So when they weren't being taught effectively, so without language, participants were much more inventive. They had to come up with interesting ideas themselves. However, with language, it was the case that participants replicated their teacher's performance very effectively. But I wonder if they were maybe being also constrained by that. So I think it would be really interesting for further work to explore whether language, despite being a really effective way to pass on information, might actually be hindering the extent that humans innovate for themselves.
That was Dr. Thomas Morgan from the University of California, Berkeley. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.